We are men of years and knowledge, and we must have the ability to discuss issues frankly. We waste too much time in our meetings kneeling before Mao's cadaver. The man is dead, Fang. Yes, he was a great man. Yes, he was a great leader for our people. But no, he wasn't the Lord Buddha, or Jesus, or whatever. He was only a man, and he had ideas, and most of them were right. But some of them were wrong. Some of them don't work. The Great Leap Forward accomplished nothing. And the Cultural Revolution, in addition to killing off undesirable intellectuals and troublemakers, also starved millions of our people to death. And that is not desirable, is it?
That is true, my young friend. But it is important how you present your ideas, Fang warned his junior, non-voting member of the Politburo.
Present them stupidly, and you'll find yourself counting rice bags on a collective farm. He was a little old to go barefoot into the paddies, even as punishment for ideological apostasy.
"Will you support me?" Chan asked.
"I will try," was the half-hearted answer. He had to plead Ren Heiping's case as well this day, and it wouldn't be easy. They'd counted on the funds transfer at Qian's ministry. They had contracts to pay for. The tanker had long since been scheduled, because they were booked well in advance, and this carrier was just now coming alongside the loading pier off the coast of Iran. She'd load 456,000 tons of crude oil over a period of less than a day, then steam back out of the Persian Gulf, turn southeast for the passage around India, then transit the crowded Malacca Strait past Singapore and north to the huge and newly built oil terminal at Shanghai, where she'd spend 30 or 40 hours offloading the cargo, then retrace her journey back to the Gulf for yet another load in an endless procession. Except that the procession wasn't quite endless. It would end when the money stopped, because the sailors had to be paid, the debt on the tanker serviced, and most of all the oil had to be bought. And it wasn't just one tanker. There were quite a few of them on the China run. A satellite focused on just that one segment of the world's oil trade would have seen them from a distance, looking like cars on a highway going to and from the same 2 points continuously. And like cars, they didn't have to go merely between those 2 places. There were other ports at which to load oil, and others at which to offload it. And to the crews of the tankers, the places of origin and destination didn't really matter very much, because almost all of their time was spent at sea. And the sea was always the same. Nor did it matter to the owners of the tankers, or the agents who did the chartering. What mattered was that they got paid for their time. For this charter, the money had been wire-transferred from one account to another. And so the crew stood at their posts watching the loading process, monitoring it mainly by watching various dials and gauges. You couldn't see the oil going through the pipes, after all. Various crew members were on the beach to see to the victualling of their ship, and to visit the chandlers to get books and magazines to read, videocassette movies, and drink to go with the food, plus whatever consumable supplies had been used up on the inbound trip. A few crewmen looked for women whose charms might be rented, but that was an iffy business in Iran. None of them knew or thought very much about who paid for their services. Their job was to operate the ship safely and efficiently. The ship's officers mainly had their wives along, for whom the voyages were extended, if rather boring, pleasure cruises. Every modern tanker had a swimming pool and a deck for tanning, plus satellite TV for news and entertainment. And none of them particularly cared where the ship went. Because for the women, shopping was shopping, and any new port had its special charms. This particular tanker, the World Progress, was chartered out of London, and had 5 more Shanghai runs scheduled until the charter ran out. The charter was paid, however, on a per-voyage basis, and the funds for this trip had been wired only 7 days before. That was hardly a matter of concern for the owners or the ship's agent. After all, they were dealing with a nation-state, whose credit tended to be good. In due course, the loading was completed. A computerized system told the ship's first officer that the ship's trim was correct, and he so notified the master, who then told the chief engineer to wind up the ship's gas turbine engines. This engine type made things easy, and in less than 5 minutes the ship's power plant was fully ready for sea. 20 minutes after that, powerful harbor tugs eased the ship away from the loading dock. This evolution is the most demanding for a tanker's crew because only in confined waters is the risk of collision and serious damage quite so real. But within 2 hours the tanker was underway under her own power, heading for the narrows at Bandar Abbas, and then the open sea.
"Yes, Chan," Premier Xu said tiredly. "Proceed."
"Comrades, at our last meeting I warned you of a potential problem of no small proportions. That problem is with us now, and it is growing larger."
"Are we running out of money, Chan?" Zhang Hansan asked, with a barely concealed smirk. The answer amused him even more.
"Yes, Zhang, we are."
"How can a nation run out of money?" the senior Politburo member demanded.
"The same way a factory worker can, by spending more than he has. Another way is to offend his boss and lose his job.
We have done both," Chan replied evenly.
"What boss do we have?" Zhang inquired, with a disarming and eerie gentleness.
"Comrades, that is what we call trade. We sell our goods to others in return for money, and we use that money to purchase goods from those others. Since we are not peasants from ancient times, bartering a pig for a sheep, we must use money, which is the means of international exchange. Our trade with America has generated an annual surplus on the order of $70 billion American.
"Generous of the foreign devils," Premier Xu observed to Zhang sotto voce.
"Which we have almost entirely spent for various items, largely for our colleagues in the People's Liberation Army of late. Most of these are long-term purchase items for which advance payment was necessary, as is normal in the international arms business. To this we must add oil and wheat. There are other things which are important to our economy, but we will concentrate on these for the moment."
Chan looked around the table for approval.
He got it, though Marshal Luo Kong, defense minister, and commander-in-chief of the People's Liberation Army, and lord of the PLA's sizable industrial empire, was now looking on with a gimlet eye. The expenditures of his personal empire had been singled out, and that was not calculated to please him.
"Comrades," Chan continued, "we now face the loss of much, perhaps most, of that trade surplus with America, and other foreign countries as well. You see these?" He held up a fistful of telexes and email printouts. "These are cancellations of commercial business orders and funds transfers. Let me clarify. These are billions of lost dollars, money which in some cases we have already spent, but money we will never have because we have angered those with whom we do business."
"You tell me that they have such power over us? Rubbish," another member observed.
"Comrade, they have the power to buy our trade goods for cash or not buy them for cash. If they choose not to buy them, we do not get the money we need to spend for Marshal Luo's expensive toys."
He used that word deliberately. It was time to explain the facts of life to these people, and a slap across the face was sure to get their attention. "Now let us consider wheat. We use wheat to make bread and noodles. If you have no wheat, you have no noodles. Our country does not grow enough wheat to feed our people. We know this. We have too many mouths to feed. In a few months, the great producing countries, America, Canada, Australia, Argentina, and so forth, they will all have wheat to sell. But with what shall we buy it? Marshal Luo, your army needs oil to refine into diesel fuel and jet fuel, does it not?
We need the same things for our diesel trains and our airlines. But we cannot produce all the oil we need for our domestic needs, and so we must buy it from the Persian Gulf and elsewhere. Again, with what shall we buy it?
So, sell our trade goods to someone else? A member asked. With rather surprising innocence, Chian thought.
Who else might there be, comrade?
There is only one America.
We have also offended all of Europe.
Whom does that leave?
Australia?
They are allied to Europe and America.
Japan?
They also sell to America, and they will move to replace our lost markets, not to buy from us.
South America, perhaps?
Those are all Christian countries, and we just killed a senior Christian churchman, didn't we?
Moreover, in their ethical world, he died heroically.
We have not just killed. We have created a holy martyr to their faith.
Comrades, we have deliberately structured our industry base to sell to the American market.
To sell elsewhere, we would first have to determine what they need that we can make, and then enter the market.
You don't just show up with a boatload of products and exchange it for cash on the dock.
It takes time and patience to become a force in such a market.
Comrades, we have cast away the work of decades.
The money we are losing will not come back for years, and until then, we must learn to live our national life differently.
What are you saying? Zhang shot back.
I am saying that the People's Republic faces economic ruin because two of our policemen killed those two meddling churchmen.
That is not possible.
It is not possible, Zhang.
If you offend the man who gives you money, then he will give you no more. Can you understand that?
We've gone far out of our way to offend America, and then we offended all of Europe as well.
We have made ourselves outcasts. They call us barbarians because of that unhappy incident at the hospital.
I do not defend them, but I must tell you what they say and think.
And as long as they say those things and think those things, it is we who will pay for the error.
I refuse to believe this, Zhang insisted.
That is fine. You may come to my ministry and add up the numbers yourself.
Chan was feeling full of himself, Fang saw. Finally, he had them listening to him. Finally, he had them thinking about his thoughts and his expertise.
Do you think I make this story up to tell in some country inn over rice wine?
Then it was Premier Xu leaning forward and thinking aloud.
You have our attention, Qian. What can we do to avert this difficulty?
Having delivered his primary message quickly and efficiently, Chan Kun didn't know what to say now. There wasn't a way to avert it that these men would accept. But having given them a brief taste of the harsh truth, now he had to give them some more.
We need to change the perception of American minds. We need to show them that we are not what they consider barbarians. We have to transform our image in their eyes. For starters, we must make amends for the deaths of those two priests.
Abase ourselves before the foreign devils, never! Zhang snarled.
Comrade Zhang, Fang said, coming carefully to Chan's defense. Yes, we are the Middle Kingdom, and no, we are not the barbarians. They are. But sometimes one must do business with barbarians, and that might mean understanding their point of view and adapting to it somewhat.
Humble ourselves before them?
Yes, Zhang. We need what they have, and to get it we must be acceptable to them.
And when they next demand that we make political changes, then what?
This was the Premier Xu, getting somewhat agitated, which was unusual for him.
We face such decisions when and if they come, Qian answered, pleasing Fang, who didn't want to risk saying that himself.
We cannot risk that, the Interior Minister, Tong Jie, responded, speaking for the first time.
The police of the nation belonged to him, and he was responsible for civil order in the country.
Only if he failed would he call upon Marshal Luo, which would cause him both loss of face and loss of power at this table. In a real sense, the deaths of the two men had been laid at his place, for he had generated the formal orders on the suppression of religious activity in the PRC, increasing the harshness of law enforcement in order to increase the relative influence of his own ministry. "If the foreigners insist upon internal political changes, it could bring us all down." And that was the core issue Fang saw at once. The People's Republic rested absolutely upon the power of the party and its leaders, these men before him in this room. Like noblemen of old, each was attended by a trusted servant, sitting in the chairs against the wall, around the table, waiting for the order to fetch tea or water. Each had his rationale for power, whether it was defense, or interior, or heavy industry, or in his particular case, friendship and general experience. Each had labored long and hard to reach this point, and none of them relished the thought of losing what he had, any more than a provincial governor under the Qing dynasty would have willingly reverted to being a mere mandarin, because that meant at least ignominy, and, just as likely, death. These men knew that if a foreign country demanded and got internal political concessions, then their grip on power would loosen, and that was the one thing they dared not risk. They ruled the workers and peasants, and because of that they also feared them. The noblemen of old could fall back upon the teachings of Confucius, or Buddha, on a spiritual foundation for their temporal power. But Marx and Mao had swept all that away, leaving only force as their defense. And if to maintain their country's prosperity they had to diminish that force, what would then happen? They didn't know. And these men feared the unknown as a child feared the evil monsters under his bed at night. But with far more reason. It had happened right here in Beijing, not all that many years before. Not one of these men had forgotten it. To the public, they'd always shown steadfast determination. But each of them, alone in his bathroom before the mirror, or lying in bed at night before sleep came, had shown fear. Because, though they basked in the devotion of the peasants and workers, somehow each of them knew that the peasants and workers might fear them, but also hated them. Hated them for their arrogance, their corruption, for their privilege, their better food, their luxurious housing, their personal servants. Their servants, they all knew, loathed them as well, behind smiles and bows of obeisance, which could just as easily conceal a dagger, because that's how the peasants and workers had felt about the nobles of 100 years before. The revolutionaries had made use of that hatred against the class enemies of that age, and new ones, they all knew, could make use of the same silent rage against themselves. And so they would cling to power with the same desperation as the nobles of old, except they would show even more ruthlessness, because unlike the nobles of old, they had no place to run to. Their ideology had trapped them in their golden cages more surely than any religion could. Fang had never before considered all of these thoughts in toto. Like the others, he'd worried a lot when the college students had demonstrated, building up their Goddess of Liberty out of plaster or papier-mâché. Fang didn't remember, though he did remember his sigh of relief when the PLA had destroyed it. It came as a surprise to him, the realization of how snared he was here in this place. The power he and his colleagues exercised was like something shown before a mirror that could be turned on them all instantly under the proper circumstances. They had immense power over every citizen in their country, but that power was all an illusion. And no, they couldn't allow another country to dictate political practices to them, because their lives all depended on that illusion. It was like smoke on a calm day, seemingly a pillar to hold up the heavens. But the slightest wind could blow it all away, and then the heavens would fall. On them all. But Fang also saw that there was no way out. If they didn't change to make America happy,
then their country would run out of wheat and oil, and probably other things as well, and they would risk massive social change in a groundswell from below. But if to prevent that they allowed some internal changes, they would just be inviting the same thing on themselves. Which would kill them the more surely?
Did it matter? Fong asked himself. Either way, they'd be just as dead.
He wondered idly how it would come, the fists of a mob, or bullets before a wall, or a rope.
No, it would be bullets. That was how his country executed people.
Probably preferable to the beheading sword of old.
What if the swordsman missed his aim, after all? It must have been a horrid mess.
He only had to look around the table to see that everyone here had similar thoughts, at least those with enough wit. All men feared the unknown, but now they had to choose which unknown to fear, and the choice was yet another thing to dread.
So, Chan, you say we risk running out of things because we can no longer get the money we need to purchase them?
Premier Xu asked.
That is correct, the finance minister confirmed.
In what other ways could we get money and oil? Xu asked next.
That is not within my purview, Chairman, Chan answered.
Oil is its own currency, Zhang said. And there is ample oil to our north. There is also gold and many other things we need. Timber in vast quantities. And that which we need most of all, space. Living space for our people.
Marshal Luo nodded.
We have discussed this before.
What do you mean? Fong asked.
The Northern Resource Area, our Japanese friends once called it, Zhang reminded them all.
That adventure ended in disaster, Fong observed at once. We were fortunate not to have been damaged by it.
But we were not damaged at all, Zhang replied lightly.
We were not even implicated. We can be sure of that, can we not, Luo?
This is so. The Russians have never strengthened their southern defenses. They even ignore our exercises that have raised our forces to a high state of readiness.
Can we be sure of that?
Oh, yes, the defense minister told them all.
Tan? He asked.
Tan Deshi was the chief of the Ministry of State Security, in charge of the PRC's foreign and domestic intelligence services. One of the younger men here at 70, he was probably the healthiest of them all, a non-smoker and a very light imbiber of alcohol.
When we first began our increased exercises, they watched with concern, but after the first 2 years they lost interest. We have over 1 million of our citizens living in eastern Siberia. It's illegal, but the Russians do not make much issue of it. A goodly number of them report to me. We have good intelligence of the Russian defenses.
And what is their state of readiness? Tong Jie asked.
Generally quite poor. They have one full-strength division, one at two-thirds, and the rest are hardly better than cadre strength. Their new Far East commander, a General Colonel Bondarenko, despairs of making things better, our sources tell us.
Wait. Fong objected. Are we discussing the possibility of war with Russia here?
Yes, Zhang Hansan replied. We have done this before.
Well, that is true, but on the first such occasion, we would have had Japan as an ally, and America neutralized. On the second, we assumed that Russia would have been broken up beforehand along religious lines. Who are our allies in this case? How has Russia been crippled?
We've been a little unlucky, Tan answered. The chief minister, well, the chief advisor to their president Grushevoy, is still alive.
What do you mean? Fong asked.
I mean that our attempt to kill him misfired.
Tan explained on for 2 minutes. The reaction around the table was one of mild shock. Tan had my approval, Xu told them calmly.
Fang looked over at Zhang Hansan. That's where the idea must have originated. His old friend might have hated capitalists, but that didn't stop him from acting like the worst pirate when it suited his goals. And he had Xu's ear, and Tan as his strong right arm. Fang thought he knew all of these men, but now he saw that his assumption had been in error. In each was something hidden and sinister. They were far more ruthless than he, Fang saw.
"That is an act of war," Fang objected.
"Our operational security was excellent. Our Russian agent, one Clementi Suvorov, is a former KGB officer we recruited ages ago when he was stationed here in Beijing. He's performed various functions for us for a long time, and he has superb contacts within both their intelligence and military communities. That is, those segments of it that are now in the new Russian underworld. In fact, he's a common criminal. A lot of the old KGB people have turned into that. But it works for us. He likes money, and for enough of it he will do anything. Unfortunately, in this case, a pure happenstance prevented the elimination of this Golovko person," Tan concluded.
"And now?" Fang asked.
Then he cautioned himself. He was asking too many questions, taking too much of a personal position here. Even in this room, even with these old comrades, it didn't pay to stand out too far.
"And now that is for the Politburo to decide," Tan replied blandly. "It had to be affected, but was well acted in any case."
Fang nodded and leaned back, keeping his peace for the moment.
"Luo," Xu asked, "is this feasible?"
The marshal had to guard his words as well, not to appear too confident. You could get in trouble around this table by promising more than you could deliver. Though Luo was in the unique position, somewhat shared by Interior Minister Tong, of having guns behind him and his position.
"Comrades, we have long examined the strategic issue here. When Russia was the Soviet Union, this operation was not possible. Their military was much larger and better supported, and they had numerous intercontinental and theater ballistic missiles tipped with thermonuclear warheads. Now they have none, thanks to their bilateral agreement with America. Today the Russian military is a shadow of what it was only 10 or 12 years ago. Fully half of their draftees do not even report when called for service. If that happened here, we all know what would happen to the miscreants, do we not? They squandered much of their remaining combat power with their Chechen religious minority. And so you might say that Russia is already splitting up along religious lines. In practical terms, the task is straightforward, if not entirely easy. The real difficulty facing us is distance and space, not actual military opposition. It's many kilometers from our border to their new oil field on the Arctic Ocean. Much fewer to the new gold field. The best news of all is that the Russian army is itself building the roads we need to make the approach. It reduces our problems by 2/3 right there. Their air force is a joke. We should be able to cope with it. They sell us their best aircraft, after all, and deny them to their own flyers. To make our task easier, we would do well to disrupt their command and control, their political stability, and so forth. Tan, can you accomplish that?"
"That depends on what exactly is the task," Tan Deshi replied.
"To eliminate Grushevoy, perhaps," Zhang speculated. "He is the only person of strength in Russia at the moment. Remove him, and their country would collapse politically."
"Comrades," Fang had to say, taking the risk, "what we discuss here is bold and daring, but also fraught with danger. What if we fail?"
"Then, my friend, we are no worse off than we appear to be already," Zhang replied.
But if we succeed, as appears likely, we achieve the position for which we have striven since our youth. The People's Republic will become the foremost power in all the world.
As is our right, he didn't have to add.
Chairman Mao never considered failing to destroy Chang, did he?
There was no arguing with that, and Feng didn't attempt it. The switchover from fear to adventurousness had been as abrupt as it was now becoming contagious. Where was the caution these men exercised so often? They were men on a floundering ship, and they saw a means of saving themselves, and having accepted the former proposition, they were catapulted into the latter. All he could do was lean back and watch the talk evolve, waiting, hoping, that reason would break out and prevail. But from whom would it come?
Chapter 41 Plots of State.
"Yes, Minister," Ming said, looking up from her almost completed notes.
"You are careful with these notes, aren't you?"
"Certainly, Comrade Minister," she replied at once. "I never even print these documents up, as you well know. Is there a concern?"
Feng shrugged.
The stresses of today's meeting were gradually bleeding off. He was a practical man of the world, and he was an elderly man. If there was a way to deal with the current problem, he would find it. If there wasn't, then he would endure. He always had. He was not the one taking the lead here, and his notes would show that he was one of the few cautious skeptics at the meeting. One of the others, of course, was Chan Kun, who'd walked out of the room shaking his head and muttering to his senior aide. Feng then wondered if Chan was keeping notes. It would have been a good move. If things went badly, those could be his only defense. At this level of risk, the hazard wasn't relegation to a menial job, but rather having one's ashes scattered in the river.
Ming?
Yes, Minister.
What did you think of the students in the square all those years ago?
I was only in school then myself, Minister, as you know.
Yes, but what did you think?
I thought they were reckless. The tallest tree is always the first to be cut down.
It was an ancient Chinese adage, and therefore a safe thing to say. Theirs was a culture that discouraged taking such action. But perversely, their culture also lionized those who'd had the courage to do so. As with every human tribe, the criterion was simple. If you succeeded, then you were a hero, to be remembered and admired. If you failed, nobody would remember you anyway, except, perhaps, as a negative example. And so safety lay always in the middle course, and in safety was life. The students had been too young to know all that, too young to accept the idea of death. The bravest soldiers were always the young ones, those spirits of great passions and beliefs, those who had not lived long enough to reflect on what shape the world took when it turned against you, those too foolish to know fear. For children, the unknown was something you spent almost all your time exploring and finding out. Somewhere along the line, you discovered that you'd learned all that was safe to learn, and that's where most men stopped, except for the very few upon whom progress depended, the brave ones and the bold ones who walked with open eyes into the unknown. And humanity remembered those few who came back alive, and soon enough forgot those who did not. But it was the substance of history to remember those who did, and the substance of Feng's society to remind them of those who didn't. Such a strange dichotomy. What societies, he wondered, encouraged people to seek out the unknown? How did they do? Did they thrive? Or did they blunder about in the darkness and lose their substance in aimless, undirected wanderings? In China, everyone followed the words and thoughts of Marx, as modified by Mao, because he had boldly walked into the darkness and returned with revolution, and changed the path of his nation. But their things had stopped,
because no one was willing to proceed beyond the regions Mao had explored and illuminated, and proclaimed to be all that China and the world in general needed to know about. Mao was like some sort of religious prophet, wasn't he? Feng reflected.
Hadn't China just killed a couple of those?
Thank you, Ming, he told her, waiting there for his next order. He didn't see her close the door as she went to her desk to transcribe the notes of this Politburo meeting.
Dear God, Dr. Sears whispered at his desk.
As usual, the Zorga document had been printed up on the DDO's laser jet and handed over to him, and he'd walked back to his office to do the translation. Sometimes the documents were short enough to translate standing in front of her desk, but this one was pretty long. It was, in fact, going to take 8 line-and-a-half-spaced pages off his laser printer. He took his time on this because of its content. He rechecked his translation. Suddenly he had doubts about his understanding of the Chinese language. He couldn't afford to mistranslate or misrepresent this sort of thing. It was just too hot. All in all, he took 2.5 hours, more than double what Mrs. Foley probably expected, before he walked back.
"What took so long?" M.P. asked when he returned.
"Mrs. Foley, this is hot."
"How hot?"
"Magma," Sears said, as he handed the folder across.
"Oh?"
She took the pages and leaned back in her comfortable chair to read it over. Zorga, source, Songbird. Her eyes catalogued the heading, Yesterday's Meeting of the Chinese Politburo. Then Sears saw it. Saw her eyes narrow as her hand reached for a butterscotch. Then her eyes shifted to him.
"You weren't kidding."
"Evaluation?"
"Ma'am, I can't evaluate the accuracy of the source, but if this is for real, well, then we're looking in on a process I've never seen before outside history books, and hearing words that nobody has ever heard in this building. Not that I've ever heard about, anyway. I mean, every minister in their government is quoted there, and most of them are saying the same thing."
"And it's not something we want them to say," Mary Patricia Foley concluded his statement. "Assuming this is all accurately reported, does it feel real?"
Sears nodded.
"Yes, ma'am. It sounds to me like real conversation by real people, and the content tracks with the personalities as I know them."
"Could it be fabricated?"
"Yes, it could. If so, the source has been compromised in some way or other. However, I don't see that this could be faked without their wanting to produce a specific effect, and that would be an effect which would not be overly attractive to them."
"Any recommendations?"
"It might be a good idea to get George Weaver down from Providence," Sears replied. "He's good at reading their minds. He's met a lot of them face to face, and he'll be a good backup for my evaluation."
"Which is?" Mary Pat asked, not turning to the last page where it would be printed up.
"They're considering war."
The deputy director, operations, of the Central Intelligence Agency stood and walked out her door, with Dr. Joshua Sears right behind her. She took the short walk to her husband's office and went through the door without even looking at Ed's private secretary. Ed Foley was having a meeting with his deputy director, Science and Technology, and two of his senior people when MP walked in. He looked up in surprise, then saw the blue folder in her hand.
"Yeah, honey?"
"Excuse me, but this can't wait even 1 minute."
Her tone of voice told as much as her words did.
"Frank, can we get together after lunch?"
"Sure, Ed."
DDS&T gathered his documents and his people and headed out. When they were gone and the door closed, the DCI asked,
"Zorga?"
Mary Pat just nodded and handed the folder across, taking a seat on the couch. Sears remained standing. It was only then that he realized his hands were a little moist. That hadn't happened to him before. Sears, as head of the DI's Office of China Assessments, worked mainly on political evaluations.
Who was who in the PRC's political hierarchy? What economic policies were being pursued? The society page for the People's Republic, as he and his people thought of it, and joked about it over lunch in the cafeteria. He'd never seen anything like this, nothing hotter than handling internal dissent. And while their methods for handling such things tended to be a little on the rough side, as he often put it, mainly it meant summary execution, which was more than a little on the rough side for those affected. The distances involved helped him to take a more detached perspective. But not on this.
"Is this for real?" the DC asked.
"Dr. Sears thinks so. He also thinks we need to get Weaver down from Brown University."
Ed Foley looked over at Sears.
"Call him. Right now."
"Yes, sir."
Sears left the room to make the call.
"Jack has to see this. What's he doing now?"
"He's leaving for Warsaw in 8 hours, remember? The NATO meeting, the photo opportunity at Auschwitz, stopping off at London on the way home for dinner at Buckingham Palace. Shopping on Bond Street," Ed added. There were already a dozen Secret Service people in London working with the Metropolitan Police and MI5, properly known as the Security Service. 20 more were in Warsaw, where security concerns were not all that much of an issue. The Poles were very happy with America right now, and the leftover police agencies from the communist era still kept files on everyone who might be a problem. Each would have a personal babysitter for the entire time Ryan was in country. The NATO meeting was supposed to be almost entirely ceremonial, a basic feel-good exercise to make a lot of European politicians look pretty for their polyglot constituents.
"Jesus, they're talking about making a move on Grushevoy,"
Ed Foley gasped, getting to page 3.
"Are they totally off their fucking rockers?"
"Looks like they found themselves in a corner unexpectedly," his wife observed. "We may have overestimated their political stability." Foley nodded and looked up at his wife.
"Right now?"
"Right now," she agreed.
Her husband lifted his phone and punched speed dial number 1.
"Yeah, Ed, what is it?" Jack Ryan asked.
"Mary and I are coming over."
"When?"
"Now."
"That important?" the president asked.
"This is critic stuff, Jack. You'll want Scott, Ben, and Arnie there, too. Maybe George Winston. The foundation of the issue is his area of expertise."
"China?"
"Yep."
"Okay, come on over."
Ryan switched phones.
"Ellen, I need Sextate, Sectrez, Ben, and Arnie in my office 30 minutes from right now."
"Yes, Mr. President," his secretary acknowledged.
This sounded hot, but Robbie Jackson was on his way out of town again to give a speech in Seattle, at the Boeing plant of all places, where the workers and the management wanted to know about the 777 order to China. Robbie didn't have much to say on that point, and so he'd talk about the importance of human rights and America's core beliefs and principles, and all that wave the flag stuff. The Boeing people would be polite about it, and it was hard to be impolite to a black man, especially one with navy wings of gold on his lapel. And learning to handle this political bullshit was Robbie's main task. Besides, it took pressure off Ryan, and that was Jackson's primary mission in life, and oddly enough, one which he accepted with relative equanimity. So his VC-20B would be over Ohio right about now, Jack thought. Maybe Indiana. Just then Andrea came in.
"Company coming?" Special Agent Price O'Day asked.
She looked a little pale, Jack thought.
"The usual suspects.
You feeling okay?" the president asked.
"Stomach is a little upset. Too much coffee with breakfast."
"Morning sickness?" Ryan wondered.
"If so, too bad."
Andrea tried so hard to be one of the boys. Admitting this female failing would scar her soul as though from a flamethrower. He couldn't say anything about it. Maybe Kathy could. It was a girl thing.
"Well, the DCI's coming over with something he says is important. Maybe they've changed the toilet paper in the Kremlin, as we used to say at Langley back when I worked there."
"Yes, sir," she smiled.
Like most Secret Service agents,
She'd seen the people and the secrets come and go, and if there were important things for her to know, she'd find out in due course. General Lieutenant Karelin liked to drink as much as most Russians, and that was quite a lot by American standards. The difference between Russians and Brits, Chavez had learned, was that the Brits drank just as much, but they did it with beer, while the Russians made do with vodka. Ding was neither a Mormon nor a Baptist, but he was over his capacity here. After two nights of keeping up with the local Joneses, he'd nearly died on the morning run with his team, and only avoided falling out for fear of losing face before the Russian Spetsnaz people they were teaching to come up to rainbow standards. Somehow he'd managed not to puke, though he had allowed Eddie Price to take charge of the first two classes that day while he'd wandered off to drink a gallon of water to chase down three aspirins. Tonight he decided he'd cut off the vodkas at 2. Maybe 3. "Now what are men doing?" the general asked. "Just fine, sir," Chavez answered. "They like their new weapons, and they're picking up on the doctrine. They're smart. They know how to think before they act."
"Does this surprise you?"
"Yes, General, it does. It was the same for me once, back when I was a squad sergeant in the ninjas. Young soldiers tend to think with their dicks rather than their brains. I learned better, but I had to learn it the hard way in the field. It's sometimes a lot easier to get yourself into trouble than it is to think yourself out of it. Your Spetsnaz boys started off that way, but if you show them the right way, they listen pretty good. Today's exercise, for example. We set it up with a trap, but your captain stopped short on the way in and thought it through before he committed, and he passed the test. He's a good team leader, by the way. I'd say bump him to major." Chavez hoped he hadn't just put the curse of hell on the kid, realizing that praise from a CIA officer wasn't calculated to be career-enhancing for a Russian officer.
"He's my nephew. His father married my sister. He's an academician, a professor at Moscow State University.
His English is superb. I'd take him for a native of Chicago."
And so Captain Leskov had probably been talent-scouted by KGB or its successor agency. Language skills of that magnitude didn't just happen.
"He was a parachutist before they sent him to Spetsnaz," Karelin went on. "A good light infantryman."
"Well, that's what Ding was once upon a time," Clark told the Russian.
7th Light Infantry. They de-established the division after I left. Seems like a long time now."
"How did you go from the American Army into CIA?"
"His fault," Chavez answered. "John spotted me and foolishly thought I had potential.
We had to clean him up and send him to school, but he's worked out pretty well. Even married my daughter."
"He's still getting used to having a Latino in the family, but I made him a grandfather. Our wives are back in Wales."
"So how did you emerge from CIA into Rainbow?"
"My fault again," Clark admitted. "I did a memo, and it perked to the top, and the president liked it, and he knows me, and so when they set the outfit up, they put me in charge of it. I wanted Domingo here to be part of it, too. He's got young legs, and he shoots okay."
"Your operations in Europe were impressive, especially at the park in Spain."
"Not our favorite. We lost a kid there."
"Yeah," Ding confirmed with a tiny sip of his drink.
"I was 50 yards away when that bastard killed Anna. Homer got him later on. Nice shot it was."
"I saw him shoot 2 days ago. He's superb."
"Homer's pretty good. Went home last fall on vacation and got himself a doll sheep at 800-plus yards up in Idaho. Hell of a trophy. He made it into the Boone and Crockett book in the top 10.
"He should go to Siberia and hunt tiger. I could arrange that," Karelin offered.
"Don't say that too loud," Chavez chuckled. "Homer will take you up on it."
"He should meet Pavel Petrovich Gogol," Karelin went on.
"Where'd I hear that name?" Clark wondered at once. "The gold mine," Chavez handled the answer.
"He was a sniper in the Great Patriotic War. He has 2 gold stars for killing Germans, and he's killed hundreds of wolves. There aren't many like him left."
"Sniper on a battlefield. The hunting must get real exciting."
"Oh, it is, Domingo. It is.
We had a guy in 3rd SOG who was good at it, but he damn near got his ass killed half a dozen times. You know, John Clark had a satellite beeper and it started vibrating in his belt. He picked it up and checked the number. "Excuse me," he said, and looked for a good place. The Moscow Officers Club had a courtyard, and he headed for it.
"What does this mean?" Arnie Van Dam asked.
The executive meeting had started with copies of the latest Zorga Songbird being passed out. Arnie was the fastest reader of the group, but not the best strategic observer.
"It doesn't mean anything good, pal," Ryan observed, turning to the third page.
"Ed," Winston asked, looking up from page 2. "What can you tell me about the source? This looks like the insider trading document from hell."
"A member of the Chinese Politburo keeps notes on his conversations with the other ministers. We have access to those notes. Never mind how."
"So this document and the source are both genuine?"
"We think so, yes."
"How reliable?" Trader persisted.
The DCI decided to take a long step out on a thin limb.
"About as reliable as one of your T-bills."
"Okay, Ed, you say so."
And Winston's head went back down. In 10 seconds, he muttered, "Shit."
"Oh, yeah, George," POTUS agreed.
"Shit about covers it."
"Concur, Jack," Sexstate agreed.
Of those present, only Ben Goodley managed to get all the way through it without a comment. For his part, Goodley, for all the status and importance that came from his job as the president's national security advisor, felt particularly junior and weak at the moment. Mainly he knew that he was far the president's inferior in knowledge of national security affairs, that he was in his post mainly as a high-level secretary. He was a carded national intelligence officer, one of whom, by law and custom, accompanied the president everywhere he went. His job was to convey information to the president. Former occupants of his corner office in the West Wing of the White House had often told their presidents what to think and what to do. But he was just an information conveyor, and at the moment he felt weak even in that diminished capacity. Finally, Jack Ryan looked up with blank eyes and a vacant face.
"Okay, Ed, Mary Pat, what do we have here?"
"It looks as if Secretary Winston's predictions on the financial consequences of the Beijing incident might be coming true."
"They're talking about precipitous consequences," Scott Adler observed coolly. "Where's Tony?"
"Secretary Britano's down at Fort Hood, Texas, looking at the heavy troopers at 3rd Corps. He gets back late tonight. If we yank him back in a hurry, people will notice," Van Dam told the rest.
"Ed, will you object if we get this to him secure?"
"No."
"Okay."
Ryan nodded and reached across his desk for his phone.
"Send Andrea in, please."
That took less than 5 seconds.
"Yes, Mr. President."
"Could you walk this over to Signals and have them tap dance it to Thunder?"
He handed her the document.
"Then please bring it back here."
"Yes, sir."
"Thanks, Andrea," Ryan told the disappearing form.
Then he took a drink of water and turned to his guests.
"Okay, it looks pretty serious."
"How serious is it?"
"We're bringing Professor Weaver down from Brown to evaluate it for us. He's about the best guy in the country for reading their minds."
"Why the hell doesn't he work for me?" Jack asked.
"He likes it at Brown. He comes from Rhode Island. We've offered him a job across the river half a dozen times that I know of," DCI Foley told Ryan. "But he always says the same thing."
"Same at state, Jack. I've known George for 15 years or more. He doesn't want to work for the government."
"Your kind of man, Jack," Arnie added for a little levity.
"Besides, he can make more money as a contractor, can't he?
Ed, when he comes down, make sure he comes in to see me."
"When?"
"You're flying out in a few hours," Ed pointed out.
"Shit."
Ryan remembered it now. Callie Weston was just finishing up the last of his official speeches in her office across the street. She was even coming across on Air Force One with the official party. Why was it that you couldn't deal with things one at a time?
Because at this level, they just didn't arrive that way.
All right, Jack said next. We need to evaluate how serious this is and then figure a way to forestall it. That means what?
One of several things. We can approach them quietly, Sextate Adler said. You know, tell them that this has gone too far, and we want to work with them on the sly to ameliorate the situation.
Except Ambassador Hitch is over there now consulting, remember?
Where's he doing it today, congressional or burning tree? POTUS asked.
Hitch enjoyed golf, a hobby he could hardly pursue in Beijing. Ryan could sympathize. He was lucky to get in one round a week, and what swing he'd once had was gone with the wind. The DCM in Beijing is too junior for something like this. No matter what we said through him, they wouldn't take it seriously enough.
And what exactly could we give them? Winston asked. There's nothing big enough to make them happy that we could keep quiet.
They'd have to give us something so that we could justify giving them anything. And from what I see here, they don't want to give us anything but a bellyache. We're limited in our action by what the country will tolerate.
You think they'd tolerate a shooting war? Adler snapped.
Be cool, Scott. There are practical considerations. Anything juicy enough to make these Chinese bastards happy has to be approved by Congress, right? To get such a concession through Congress would mean giving them the justification for it.
Winston waved the secret document in his hand.
But we can't do that because Ed here would have a fit. And even if we did, somebody on the Hill would leak it to the papers in a New York minute. And half of them would call it Danegeld and say, fuck the chinks, millions for defense but not one penny for tribute. Am I right?
Yes, Arnie answered. The other half would call it responsible statesmanship. But the average Joe out there wouldn't much like it. The average citizen would expect you to call Premier Xu on the phone and say, better not do this, buddy, and expect it to stick.
Which would, by the way, kill Songbird, Mary Pat added as a warning, lest they take that option seriously.
That would end a human life and deny us further information that we need to have. And from my reading of this report, Xu would deny everything and just keep going forward. They really think they're in a corner, but they can't see a way to smart themselves out of it.
The danger is? Trader asked.
Internal political collapse, Ryan explained. They're afraid that if anything upsets the political or economic conditions inside the country, the whole house of cards comes tumbling down, with serious consequences for the current royal family of the PRC.
Called the chop.
Ben Goodley had to say something, and that was an easy one.
Actually, a rifle bullet today.
It didn't help him feel much better. He was out of his depth, and he knew it.
That's when the president's stew rang. It was SecDef Tony Britano, Thunder.
Yeah, Ryan said, putting you on speaker, Tony. Scott, George, Arnie, Ed, Mary Pat, and Ben are here. And we just read what you got.
I presume this is real?
Real as hell, Ed Foley told the newest member of the Zorga Songbird Chorus.
This is worrisome.
On that we are agreed, Tony. Where are you now?
Standing on top of a Bradley in the parking lot. Never seen so many tanks and guns in my life. Feels like real power here.
Yeah, well, what you just read shows you the limits of our power.
So I gather.
If you want to know what I think we should do about it,
well, make it clear to them somehow that this would be a really bad play for them.
How do we do that, Tony? Adler asked.
Some animals, the pufferfish, for example. When threatened, it swallows a gallon of water and expands its size, makes it look too big to eat.
Ryan was surprised to hear that.
He'd no idea that Britano knew anything about animals. He was a physics and science guy.
Well, maybe he watched the Discovery Channel like everyone else.
Scare them, you mean?
Impress them, better way of putting it.
Jack, we're going to Warsaw. We can let Grushevoy know about this. How about we invite him into NATO? The Poles are there already. It would commit all of Europe to come to Russia's defense in the event of an invasion. I mean, that's what alliances and mutual defense treaties are all about. You're not just messing with me, Charlie. You're messing with all my friends, too. It's worked for a long time.
Ryan considered that one and looked around the room.
Thoughts?
It's something, Winston thought.
But what about the other NATO countries?
Will they buy into this? The whole purpose of NATO, Goodley reminded them, was to protect them from the Russians.
The Soviets, Adler corrected, not the same thing anymore, remember?
The same people, the same language, sir, Goodley persisted.
He felt pretty secure on this one.
What you propose is an elegant possible solution to the present problem, but to make it happen, we'd have to share Zorger with other countries, wouldn't we?
The suggestion made the Foleys both wince. There were few things on the planet as talkative as a chief of government.
What the hell, we've been watching their military with overheads for a long time.
We can say that we're catching stuff there that makes us nervous. Good enough for the unwashed, the DCI offered.
Next, how do we persuade the Russians? Jack wondered aloud. This could be seen in Moscow as a huge loss of face.
We have to explain the problem to them. The danger is to their country, after all, Adler pronounced.
But they're not unwashed. They'll want to know chapter and verse, and it is their national security we're talking about here, Goodley added.
You know who's in Moscow now? Foley asked POTUS.
John?
Rainbow Six.
John and Ding both know Golovko, and he's Grushevoy's number one boy. It's a nice, convenient back channel. Note that this also confirms that the Moscow rocket was aimed at him. Might not make Sergei Nikolaevich feel better, but he'd rather know than guess.
Why can't those stupid fucking people just say they're sorry they shot those two people? Ryan wondered crossly.
Why do you think pride is one of the seven deadly sins? The DCI asked in reply.
Clark's portable phone was a satellite type with a built-in encryption system. Really just a quarter-inch thick plastic pad that actually made the phone easier to cradle against his shoulder. Like most such phones, it took time to synchronize with its companion on the other end, the task made harder by the delay inherent in the use of satellites.
"Line is secure," the synthetic female voice said finally.
"Who's this?"
"Ed Foley, John. How's Moscow?"
"Pleasant."
"What gives, Ed?" John asked.
The DCI didn't call from D.C. on a secure line to exchange pleasantries.
"Get over to the embassy. We have a message we want you to deliver."
"What sort?"
"Get to the embassy. It'll be waiting, okay?"
"Roger. Out."
John killed the phone and walked back inside.
"Anything important?" Chavez asked.
"We have to go to the embassy to see somebody," Clark replied, simulating anger at the interruption of his quiet time of the day.
"See you tomorrow, then, Ivan and Domingo," Karelin saluted them with his glass.
"What gives?" Chavez asked from 30 feet away.
"Not sure, but it was Ed Foley who paged me."
"Something important?"
"I guess we'll just have to wait and see."
"Who drives?"
"Me."
John knew Moscow fairly well, having learned it first on missions in the 1970s that he was just as happy to forget about, when his daughters had been the age of his new grandson. The drive took 20 minutes, and the hard part turned out to be persuading the Marine Guard that they really were entitled to come inside after normal business hours. To this end, the man waiting for them, Tom Barlow, proved useful. The Marines knew him, and he knew them, and that made everything okay, sort of.
"What's the big deal?" John asked, when they got to Barlow's office.
"This."
He handed the fax across, a copy to each.
"Might want to take a seat, guys."
"Madre de Dios," Chavez gasped 30 seconds later.
"Roger that, Domingo," his boss agreed. They were reading a hastily laundered copy of the latest Zorga dispatch.
"We got us a source in Beijing, mano."
"Hang a big Roger on that one, Domingo. And we're supposed to share the take with Sergei Nikolaevich. Somebody back home is feeling real ecumenical."
"Fuck," Chavez observed.
Then he read on a little.
"Oh, yeah, I see. This does make some sense.
Barlow, we have a phone number for our friend?"
"Right here."
The CIA officer handed over a post-it note and pointed to a phone.
"He'll be out at his dacha, out in the Lenin Hills. They haven't changed the name yet.
Since he found out he was the target, he's gotten a little more security-conscious.
"Yeah, we've met his babysitter, Shalepin," Chavez told Barlow.
"Looks pretty serious."
"He'd better be. If I read this right, he might be called up to bat again, or maybe Grushevoy's detail."
"Is this for real?" Chavez had to wonder. "I mean, this is casus belli stuff."
"Well, Ding, you keep saying that international relations is two countries fucking each other."
Then he dialed the phone.
"Tovarish Golovko," he told the voice that answered it, adding in Russian, "It's clerk, Ivan Sergeyevich."
"That'll get his attention," John told the other two.
"Greetings, Vanya,"
a familiar voice said in English.
"I will not ask how you got this number.
What can I do for you?"
"Sergey, we need to see you at once on an important matter."
"What sort of matter?"
"I am the mailman, Sergey. I have a message to deliver to you. It is worthy of your attention. Can Domingo and I see you this evening?"
"Do you know how to get here?"
Clark figured he'd find his way out to the woods. "Just tell the people at the gate to expect two capitalist friends of Russia. Say about an hour from now."
"I will be waiting."
"Thank you, Sergey."
Clark replaced the phone.
"Where's the piss parlor, Barlow?"
"Down the hall on the right."
The senior field intelligence officer folded the fax and tucked it into his coat pocket. Before having a talk about something like this, he needed a bathroom. Chapter 42 Birch Trees. They drove into the sunset west from the Russian capital. Traffic had picked up in Moscow since his last real adventure here, and you could use the center lane in the wide avenues. Ding handled navigation with a map, and soon they were beyond the ring roads around the Russian capital and entering the hills that surrounded the city. They passed a memorial which neither had ever seen before. Three huge...
"What the hell is that?" Ding asked.
"This is as close as the Germans got in 1941, John explained. "This is where they stopped him."
"What do you call those things?"
Those things were immense steel I-beams, three of them welded at 90-degree angles to look like enormous jacks.
"Hedgehogs. But in the SEALs we called them horned scullies. Hard to drive a tank over one," Clark told his younger partner.
"They take their history serious here, don't they?"
"You would, too, if you stopped somebody who wanted to erase your country right off the map, sonny. The Germans were pretty serious back then, too. It was a very nasty war, that one."
"Guess so.
Take the next right, Mr. C."
10 minutes later, they were in a forest of birch trees, as much a part of the Russian soul as vodka and borscht. Soon thereafter, they came to a guard shack. The uniformed guard held an AK-47 and looked surprisingly grim. Probably briefed on the threat to Golovko and others, John imagined. But he'd also been briefed on who was authorized to pass, and they only had to show their passports to get cleared, the guard also giving them directions about which country lane to take.
"The houses don't look too bad," Chavez observed.
"Built by German POWs," John told him. "Ivan doesn't exactly like the Germans very much, but he does respect their workmanship. These were built for the Politburo members, mainly after the war, probably."
"Well, there's our place."
It was a wood-frame house, painted brown and looking like a cross between a German country house and something from an Indiana farm, Clark thought. There were guards here, too, armed and walking around. They'd been called from the first shack, John figured. One of them waved. The other two stood back, ready to cover the first one if something untoward happened.
"You are clerk, Ivan Sergeyevich?"
"Da," John answered.
"This is Chavez Domingo Stepanovich."
"Pass. You are expected."